whose presentation of the Vedic tradition is more coherent, more compelling, and so on, that of Fritz Stahl or that of Srila Prabhupada. So at some time, actually, be nice to, maybe I can do it for a future course, is go over that that little interchange between the two of them, because it's very, very interesting how it actually works and how things are resolved in this thing. So there, I think Stahl says himself, says quoting a text will not simply be enough, because if texts are simply by themselves authoritative, then he says this one ought to be authoritative too, and he quotes some texts on his side. And Prabhupada says, yes, that's right, texts aren't authoritative. There has to be parampara, spiritual transmission through the disciplic succession. And where Stahl doesn't really have much to say. Okay, now we are going to, I'm going to go on a little bit quicker today. This is something I want to do. So as you recall, we have seen the discussion between the two rishis, and here's my outline. There it is. We've seen the discussion between the two rishis, and Vyasadeva has agreed to expose. I mean, Narada has agreed, Vyasadeva, as he said, to expose the cause of my despondency. And why am I sad? Why am I upset? And so he tells him, why is he upset? What's the reason? What is his root cause? The prompt diagnosis. Yeah. He deliberately avoided. He had more or less improperly used his valuable time. This is in the purport to text 9. That's his prompt diagnosis. So there was an imbalance. We at least say there was an imbalance in his presentation. We discussed how much he had just sort of reduplicated the Vedas as they were. And just pass them on. And Narada says, no, now something more has to be done than just, you just can't be, you have to arrange it in a special way for Kali Yuga. And so that brings us up to text number 10 here. 10 and 11 go together. And 11, text 11, is the verse that Prabhupada puts in the frontispiece of this first volume of Srimad Bhagavatam. And there's a personal credo in text 11, which I want to call your attention to. So in 10, those words which do not describe the glories of the Lord, who alone can sanctify the atmosphere of the whole universe, are considered by saintly persons to be likened to a place of pilgrimage for crows. Since the all-perfect persons are inhabitants of the transcendental abode, they do not derive any pleasure there. So Prabhupada says, he talks about the place of pilgrimage for crows. What is a place of pilgrimage for crows? A garbage dump. You have to really go to Calcutta to appreciate, because here we have pigeons, but in India they have crows. They serve the same function, especially in Calcutta. So the refuse heaps and the garbage dumps are filled with crows. So that is a place of pilgrimage for crows. So there's a metaphor here of two kinds of birds in the text. Vyasa, which is a crow, and a hamsa, which is a swan. Well, it's not really a swan, actually. If you actually see the Indian swan, it looks more like a duck. It's not like in India, the swan does not have this really super long neck and everything. It's a pretty bird, but we would call it a duck. But of course, you can't say topmost duck-like devotee. That doesn't but doesn't make it in English for some reason. So we say swan. But the hums. No, if you look at the anyway. So there's the literature of the and the Hamsa is a pun on, of course, the Paramahamsa, the great swan-like devotees. They're also called Hamsas. Prabhupada says Hamsa because the Hamsa is credited with the ability, when it sips a mixture of milk and water, to discriminate. I mean, you have milk and water mixed together in a solution. And the Hamsa is credited with the ability to go and stick its bill in and take out the milk and leave the water. So this is the power of discrimination, to separate matter from spirit, which in the material world is everything's mixed up. So therefore, the word Hamsa is used to refer to spiritual persons. It says that in the Satya Yuga, there's only one Varna, one caste, and they're called Hamsas. But their leaders are called Paramahamsas. And later, in the Treta Yuga, the castes drop out one after another. So, anyway, these place of pilgrimages for crows. So, this is the fruitive workers or passionate men are compared to the crows, right? And the swans do not take pleasure in places where crows are assembled for conferences and meetings. A congregation of crows. Sounds nice, huh? They are instead seen in the atmosphere of natural scenic beauty, where there are transparent reservoirs of water nicely decorated with stems of lotus flowers in variegated colors of natural beauty. That's where the swans are. Okay, so similarly, there are different kinds of literature for different kinds of men of different mentality. Mostly the market literatures, which you see in the bookstores, which attract men of the crows categories, are literatures containing, I love this phrase, refused remnants of sensuous topics. They are generally known as mundane talks in relation with the gross body and subtle mind. They are full of subject matter described in decorative language, full of mundane similes and metaphorical arrangements. So this is good literature, too, is included here, not just, you know, Stephen King trash, but really good stuff. Geoffrey Chaucer trash, William Shakespeare trash, and so on. Yet with all that, they do not glorify the Lord. Such poetry and prose on any subject matter is considered decoration of the dead body. So these literatures in the mode of passion and ignorance are distributed under different labels, but they can hardly help the spiritual urge of the human being, and thus the swan-like spiritually advanced men have nothing to do with them. So he describes them. Social literary men, scientists, mundane poets, theoretical philosophers, and politicians who are completely absorbed in the material advancement of sense pleasure, that's what they see, a goal of life, are all dolls of the material energy. They take pleasure in a place where rejected subject matters are thrown. But literatures which describe the glories of the Lord, that's the difference. It's really the subject matter that makes the difference, are enjoyed by the Paramahamsas who have grasped the essence of human activities. So that's the first verse. It describes these two groups, the literature that do not glorify the Lord and is a place of pilgrimage for crows, considered to be like that by the Paramahamsas. And those who Paramahamsas, as they live in the spiritual world, they don't take any pleasure in them. Now the next verse, this is the one that Prabhupada puts at the beginning of Bhagavatam, Tadvagvisargo janatagaviplavo yasmin prati shlokam abhajavantyapi namnam yanantasya yaso nikani nikatani yat sunvanti gayanti grinanti sarabaha. On the other hand, you know what I want to do with this one? To appreciate this purport, I want to read you the whole purport, and I want to read it to you in Prabhupada's original English. Now, Prabhupada wrote in a dialect of English, I guess. I don't know if it's a dialect. I don't know what it counts as. Indian English. It's a dialect of English. It's a standard. It's in India. There's the English that Indians speak among themselves. It's its own special little language. It's not a literary language. It's not written. When Indians sit down to write, many times, then they write a different kind of, they write an international standard English. But when they talk among themselves, they speak in this dialect. Well, Prabhupada wrote in that dialect. It has Hindi sentence structure to it. It's very recognizable. Sometimes it's called Babu English. So it's a different language. Now, what we have done with Prabhupada's books, like the first volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam, we have rewritten them in standard international English. And occasionally something is lost. I mean, not the substance or the truth of what Prabhupada has to say. But something, because actually in his native English, Prabhupada's a literary genius. And it's just like if you take Robert Burns, who wrote in Scots dialect, and he translated into standard English, something is gone. The same, similar sort of thing happens to Srila Prabhupada. So this verse especially, this purport, to really appreciate the meaning of this purport, you have to hear it in the original language, because the purport is about language, and Prabhupada's referring to his own language. So what I thought I'd do is, I want to read this to you as Prabhupada actually wrote it in the unedited, before it was edited. And we had to edit it, there's no way around it, because a lot of people wouldn't recognize this form of English. They'd say there was something wrong with it. So he says, this is the translation. On the other hand, the literature which is full with description of transcendental glories, of the name, fame, form, pastimes, etc., of the unlimited Supreme Lord, is a different creation of transcendental vocabulary, all meant for bringing about a revolution in the impious life of a misdirected civilization of the world. Such transcendental literature, even though irregularly composed, is heard, sung, and accepted by the purified men who are thoroughly honest. What you miss is that the rhythm that Prabhupada builds up here. So Prabhupada, I'll read Prabhupada's purport now. This is Prabhupada's personal manifesto about his hopes for Srimad Bhagavatam, because here is now the literature of the swans, which is so wonderful that even if it's not properly composed, it's still to be preferred to the crow literature, no matter how nicely done that is. So Prabhupada begins, "It is part of qualification of the great thinkers to pick up best even from the worst. It is said that intelligent man should pick up nectar from the stock of poison. He should accept gold even from the filthy place. He should accept a good and qualified wife even from the obscure family. And he should accept good lesson from a man or from a teacher who may come from the untouchables." Anybody know where that's said? Yeah, it's Chanakya Pandit. "These are some of the ethical instructions for everyone in every place without any exception. But a saint is far above the level of an ordinary man, and he is always absorbed in the business of glorifying the Supreme Lord. Because by broadcasting the holy name, fame of the Supreme Lord, the polluted atmosphere of the world will have a change of heart of the people in general, And as a result of such propaganda through the transcendental literatures like Srimad Bhagavatam, people will become sane in their transactions honestly and diligently. While preparing this commentation on this particular stanza of Srimad Bhagavatam, we have a crisis before us that our neighboring friend China has attacked the border of India in a militant spirit. This was, I think, 1960 or 61. This border war broke out between China and India. We have practically no business in the political field, and yet we study a situation that in old age there were both China and India, and they lived together peacefully for centuries without any ill feeling between them. The reason is that they lived in those days in an atmosphere of God consciousness, and therefore every country over the surface of the world was God-fearing, pure-hearted, simple, populous, and there was no question of political diplomacy for nothing. Practically, there is no cause of quarrel between the two countries of China and India on the issue of a land which is not very suitable for habitation, and reasonably, there is no cause of fighting on this issue. But due to the age of quarrel, Kali, which we have discussed in these pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, there is always a chance of quarrel on slight provocation. This is not due to the issue at question, but is due to the polluted atmosphere of this age, where systematically there is propaganda by a section of the people to stop glorification of the name and fame of the Supreme Lord. That's in bold in the original text. Therefore, there is great need of disseminating the message of Srimad Bhagavatam all over the world. It is the duty of every responsible Indian to broadcast the transcendental message of Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the world to do them the supermost good, as well as to bring about the desired peace in the world. Because India has failed in her duty. By neglecting this responsible work, there is so much quarrel and trouble all over the world. We are confident if the transcendental messages of Srimad Bhagavatam is received only by the leading men of the world, certainly there will be a change of heart, and naturally the people in general will follow them. The mass of people in general are, so to say, tools in the hands of the modern politicians and leaders of the people. If there is a change of heart of the leaders only, certainly there will be a radical change in the atmosphere of the world situation. We know that in our honest attempt for presenting this great literature, conveying transcendental message for reviving the God consciousness of the people in general, as a matter of re-spiritualization of the world atmosphere, is fraught with many difficulties. Regard being had to the facts that our capacity for presenting the matter in adequate language, especially a foreign language, will certainly fail. And there may be so many literary discrepancies in spite of our honest attempt to present it in the proper way. But we are sure that with our all faults in this connection, the seriousness of the subject matter will be taken into consideration, and the leaders of the society will still accept this on account of its being an honest attempt for glorifying the Almighty Great, so much now badly needed. When there is a fire in the house, the inmates of the house go out for help from the neighbors, who may be foreigners to such inmates, and yet without any adequate language, the victims of the fire express themselves, and the neighbors understand the need, even though not expressed in adequate language. The same spirit of cooperation is needed in the matter of broadcasting this transcendental message of the Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the whole polluted atmosphere of the present-day world situation. After all, it is a technical science of spiritual values, and as such, we are concerned with techniques and not with the language. If the techniques of this great literature are understood by the people of the world, there is the success. When there is too much materialistic activities by the people in general all over the world, there is nothing to be astonished if a person or nation attacks another person or nation on slight provocation. That is the rule of this age of Kali or quarrel. The atmosphere is already polluted with corruption of all descriptions, and everyone knows it well than we can describe herewith. There are so many unwanted literatures full of materialistic ideas of sense gratification. In many countries, there are census bodies appointed by the state to detect obscene literature. This means both the government and the saner section of public do not want that such unwanted literature should be published, but still, they are in the marketplace because the people want it for sense gratification. The people in general want to read. That is a natural instinct, but because their mind is polluted, they want such literatures. Under the circumstances, transcendental literatures like Srimad Bhagavatam will not only diminish activities of the corrupted mind of the people in general, but also it will supply food for their hankering after reading some interesting literature. In the beginning, they may not like it, because in the disease condition suffering from jaundice, one is reluctant to take sugar candy. But we may know it that sugar candy is the only remedy for the jaundice disease. Similarly, let there be a systematic propaganda for popularizing reading of the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, which will act like sugar candy in the jaundice-like disease condition of sense gratification. When they have a taste for this literature, the other literatures which are catering poison in the society will then automatically cease. Because they will cease to read them on account of transcendental literature like Srimad Bhagavatam being available for reading propensity. We are sure, therefore, that everyone in the human society will welcome Srimad Bhagavatam, even though it is now presented with so many faulty and broken linguistic technicalities, because it is recommended by such an authorized personality as Sri Narada, who has very kindly appeared from this chapter. So there's that's an incredible document, isn't it? Anyway, that's Prabhupada's manifestation of his expectations from Srimad Bhagavatam. Here he was all by himself in India in the late 50s and early 60s, and writing this thing up on his little bitty typewriter and getting it printed, and it's full of typos and hasn't been proofread properly or edited. And he had it printed up in his own expense. But his hope was, you can imagine how foolish it seemed, his hope was that somehow or other these poorly printed, badly bound, full of so many literary discrepancies would somehow revolutionize human civilization. He said, well, this guy's crazy, you know? How can you expect that? But look what happened. I mean, you wouldn't have predicted what he's gotten so far. Well, the revolution hasn't happened yet. So he starts off with this saying by Chanakya Pandit to say it's ordinary moral instructions for anybody to take the best from the worst. And so what he's saying here, if it applies to anybody, that if there's something good, if there's a stool in the middle of gold, a qualified woman for a wife, even though from a bad family, you take good instructions even from a low-born person, then you take it. This is a rule for ordinary persons. How much more for saintly persons to follow such a rule? So therefore, I'm presenting Srimad Bhagavatam. It may seem to you that I'm not very good at this task. It may seem to you that my English is not up to it. I admit it, he says, with our all faults, he says. I admit it, but still, that's his plea, that be overlooked. Because here it's said by Narada Muni, even if it's irregularly composed, it's still accepted by the sadhaka, by the sadhavas, those who are thoroughly honest. So this is Prabhupada making his plan that somehow or other, he says we see that this Kali Yuga is in there. He took this incident, this border war breaking out between India and China, as an example of quarrel. There's a piece of border between India and China that nobody, you can't live on it, it's just bare rock. And yet India and China were about ready to go to war for it. And this is the age of quarrel is in this shape. Why is it here? Because, he says, there's a systematic propaganda to stop glorification of the name and the fame of the Supreme Lord. In other words, by the educational elite in the Western world, this is the systematic propaganda. So he, in order to counteract this, he wants Bhagavatam to go all over the world. He said, first of all, it's the duty of India to do this. And he says, India has failed in her duty. Because India has failed in the duty, therefore the world's in the shape it's in now. So he says, Prabhupada gives a scheme, which he was thinking of at that time he wrote this, that if it's received, because how will this get disseminated all over the world? He's thinking just a few people pick it up, leaders. Here he said, if the leaders take it up, but Prabhupada's first hope was that maybe you could get the intelligent sector of human society to accept Srimad Bhagavatam, to accept Vedic literature as presented, and then if they change, then everybody else will change. And that was actually Prabhupada's initial idea when he came, which he modified later on due to experience, that these people were the last group that will take it up. But at any rate, and that's when he then makes his plea that this is much needed, and that you should overlook the difficulties of the language and the imperfectness of his composition. And he gives the example. When there's a fire in the house, somehow or other people manage to communicate. Even if you're a foreigner, you can somehow or other give everybody the idea that there's an emergency, there's a fire in the house, and the business is understood. He calls this a spirit of cooperation. When there's a desire, when someone has something urgent to say and you really want to hear it, when there's a spirit of cooperation, and then there's understanding takes place. So he's making a plea for this spirit of cooperation. Because most people, when they saw these books, when I joined the movement, we didn't have anything but those original volumes of Srila Prabhupada. And, you open them up and you see all these typos and everything like that, and people will just, oh, come on. Take them seriously. So, but if he's making a plea here that let's have the spirit of cooperation. Don't just dismiss everything. Just sit down and hear what have to say first. He says, there's a technical science of spiritual values. We are concerned with the techniques, so therefore it is transmissible. So, and then he also discusses the fact that, there is this spread of corruption in the form of obscene literature. So you can see already people know that it's bad. Governments don't want it. I mean, most governments don't want obscene literature. What they think is you have to let obscene literature flourish in order to allow freedom of speech. But most people understand that it's bad for you. Bad for people in general. So people really don't want it. But if you can pass all the legislation you want, and if people still desire it, they're going to make any difference. So he's saying just these censorship bodies, they don't really work anyway. But he says people's desire to read is there, but because the mind is polluted, therefore they want this polluted kind of literature. So he says, transcendental literature will act as an antidote to this poison in society. But then he says this, in the beginning they may not like it. And he gives this the sugar candy example. Apparently, if you have jaundice, sugar candy will cure it. You just take rock candy and suck on it. But also because of the jaundice condition, rock candy tastes bitter. And therefore, it's not very palatable. So although it's sugar and it's sweet, and it's the cure for your disease makes you make something that's sweet taste bitter. So similarly, Srimad Bhagavatam, which is transcendentally sweet, to somebody who's in a materialistic disease condition, they won't like it. But somehow or other they can continue to receive exposure to it, he says, then gradually the taste for the other literature will subside. So Prabhupada sees here that it's not going to be a simple thing people will not throw away Penthouse and Playboy. And once Srimad Bhagavatam is there, it won't be quite as simple as that. Anyway, this is his conviction that it will work. And why is that? Because, he concludes, "We are sure, therefore, that everyone in the human society will welcome Srimad Bhagavatam, even though it is now presented with so many faulty and broken linguistic technicalities." Because, why will they accept it, even though it's imperfectly composed? Because it is recommended by such an authorized person as Sri Narad, who has very kindly appeared from this chapter. I just wanted you to hear that in the original. It's quite inspiring. It's something to read. Any questions so far? So now Narada Muni has discussed these two kinds of literature. And notice, this transcendental literature is capable, as Prabhupada translates it, of creating a revolution in the world's misdirected civilization. And Prabhupada has given the example that by distribution of literature, the communist revolution was able to take hold. It's not unprecedented that books of political philosophy, revolutionary philosophy, can in fact change things around. So this is from this verse. There's the idea that simply by distributing books, literature, by getting people absorbed in reading Srimad Bhagavatam, understanding Srimad Bhagavatam, appreciating Srimad Bhagavatam, the whole thing can be turned over. Remember, that's practically the purport of this chapter. Why is Srimad Bhagavatam being recommended now by Narad Muni? He's saying any literature that's connected with the gross body and subtle mind for sense gratification will not save people. It has to be transcendental literature in connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is the only one that can save people. So then we go on. If we look at text 12, now Narad Muni goes on to continue. Now he's talking again about material literature, or at least the part of the Vedas that is not concerned with devotional service. He says, knowledge of self-realization, nice karmia. Knowledge of self-realization, even though freed from all material affinity, does not look well if devoid of a conception of the infallible God. Achyuta bhava varjitam. If it's devoid of achyuta bhava means relationship with God, or the conception of God, the idea of God. If that's not there, so even renunciation, even spiritual endeavors, if it is atheistic or non-theistic, na shobate, it's not effulgent, doesn't shine forth, doesn't look good, he says. So he says, kutapana, what then, what is to say, what to speak then about fruit of activities, which are naturally painful from the very beginning and transient by nature, if they are not utilized for the devotional service of the Lord? So both of these things, whether they're activities in the material world or they're completely nice karma, giving up the fruits of the work altogether, if any of those not connected with Krishna, he says, they're not auspicious. Abhadram, he says. Bhadra means auspicious. So he calls them abhadram, inauspicious. They don't look auspicious. And Prabhupada says here in the purport, not only ordinary literatures devoid of the transcendental glorification of the Lord are condemned, but also Vedic literatures and speculation on the subject of impersonal Brahman when they are devoid of devotional service. So there you have that, the critique. It extends also here to Vedic literature. Such speculative knowledge and fruitive work cannot lead one to the goal of perfection. So now Narada Muni has laid down his case and showed him the deficiencies of his work so far. Now he encourages him. O Vyas, your vision is completely perfect. Your good fame is spotless. You are firm in vow and situated in truthfulness. And thus you can think of the pastimes of the Lord and trance for the liberation of the people in general from all material bondage. And the word akila, universal bondage, the people of everybody's bondage. And there's a theme here now of a concern for everybody. Because actually Vyasadeva's attempt had been to make Vedic literature more and more accessible to everybody. And Narada Muni is saying, you know, you failed to do that. It's really not going to work. You didn't go far enough in your endeavors. You have to remember that Krishna describes even the knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita as secret and confidential. In the normal Vedic process, you progress upward through karma kanda to jnana kanda, and then you become an enlightened jnani, and then you discover Vasudeva Sarvam, Krishna is everything, and you surrender him at the end of a long spiritual journey over many, many births and much trouble. If you just follow the normal procedure. So in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna discloses devotional service and offers devotional service, he tells Arjuna this is confidential. It's a secret. Not everybody figures it out. Most people are not interested in transcendence. Those who are interested in transcendence, very few get it. Those who get it, very few understand Krishna. This is all throughout the Bhagavad Gita. This is a rare business. So now this rare, secret, hidden, esoteric knowledge of the Vedas is now getting publicized. So there's a reversal that's taking place. Krishna consciousness, which is the highest and most secret level of the Vedas, is being made known to everybody. Well, how far do you go? That's the question. Vyasadeva went so far and stopped. Narada Muni is saying you have to go further. I've not heard that it was a secret mantra. It was certainly there. It's in the Upanishad, but I hadn't heard that it was secret.
Well, it was not meant for the other classes.
Well, no Vedic mantras. In fact, you know, if you look in the actual Upanishad, which is called the Kalasantara Upanishad, which has the Hare Krishna mantra in it, the Rama is first and then Krishna, and it starts with Om. Well, you can't chant Vedic mantras beginning with Om unless you're a Brahmin. So you turn it around, it's not a Vedic mantra. It's not a Shruti mantra anymore. Therefore, anybody can chant it. But there's an interesting, there's a story that's told by about Ramanuja, Acharya, that his spiritual master, his spiritual master tells him that this is I'm going to give you a mantra that's very, very secret, not to utter it to anyone, because it's so powerful that anyone who chants it will immediately attain liberation. As soon as he heard the mantra, he went and broadcasted it and told everybody. So you have to understand that what to us may seem, you know, common knowledge at this point is not, up until Kali Yuga, common knowledge. It's made common knowledge. Because something that is very secret and very, very advanced and very, very rare, is now being disclosed to everybody. So this has this atmosphere. Well, you know, you can go too far in this. Once you popularize stuff, sometimes some people make it cheap. Look what happens with the dangers, for example. And Krishna mentions this danger, when I appear in my human-like form, some people are going to think, oh, God is a human being, I'm a human being, therefore I'm God. They'll think God is an ordinary person, they'll think that an ordinary person is God. Why is Krishna going to let people know who he is, when all you're going to do is deride him? So it's a secret business. And there's dangers in this disclosure. In fact, we know what these dangers are, and we get them. You have a Sahajiya movement. Because Lord Chaitanya made available to people the innermost workings of the emotional life of transcendence. Then you had a Sahajiya movement. Oh, I want that too, but I don't want to follow the regular principles. We can't discriminate. So there are dangers. And so that's why this disclosure is something that's new. And we can say, when Prabhupada says that when you say something is confidential, Prabhupada gives us a definition, confidential, guhyam, that not everyone will appreciate it. It's true. You know, if I go sit down on a train and I pull out my wallet and I got pictures of my, you know, my children and all the grandchildren, and I start to the guy, you know, not everybody's going to appreciate it. It's confidential. My relatives will appreciate it, you know, but not utter strangers. They don't appreciate that. So the Vedic knowledge is confidential. And it still is confidential, because even though now we can go and hand it out to everybody, not everybody appreciates it. So in a way, it still remains secret, although we have to say at this point it's an open secret. And the reason it can be an open secret, as Prabhupada says here, it's a technical science. In other words, if you follow the process, then you can actually become sufficiently qualified. If there's a higher and higher levels of higher knowledge of the Vedas, how can you bring it down to where anybody can appreciate it? Well, anybody can't. That anybody has to become just as pure as the purest Brahman was ever in the olden days or in the Treta Yuga. But now we have to take to a process which can work that much more powerfully on the available common material of this age. And practically, of course, nobody is qualified anymore to receive it. So therefore, he says he wants to think of these pastimes for the liberation of the people in general from material bondage. So in the purport here, Prabhupada stresses again that people have a taste for literature, but they have become unfortunate victims of worthless literatures. And thus, Narada Muni advises Sri Vyasadeva to compose transcendental literature, which is not only attractive, it's not necessarily we have to renounce the attractive feature, which is not only attractive, but can also actually bring liberation from all kinds of bondage. He says there are thousands and thousands of literary men all over the world, and they have created many, many thousands of literary works for the information of the people in general for thousands and thousands of years. Well, that's true. Unfortunately, none of them have brought peace and tranquility to the earth. It's a fact. Nothing's worked so far. This is due to a spiritual vacuum in those literatures. By the way, it's not standard English to say literatures. It's standard English to say literature. Sounds odd to people if we follow. The editors should have caught this one, but they didn't know it in such literature. Therefore, the Vedic says here, the Vedic literatures, it'd be better just say the Vedic literature. It's a collective noun. I've never seen it anywhere in the plural except in ISKCON writings like this. So so he goes on to describe how Vyasadeva is competent to actually see the pastimes of Krishna and put them down as they actually are, that he's a liberated soul, and only these liberated souls can see the pastimes of the Lord. If we want to accurately know Krishna's pastimes or accurately understand Krishna, we have to go to knowledge received from liberated persons. Either we are a liberated person and can see Krishna directly ourselves, or if we are not, we can repeat what we have heard from liberated persons, and then our description is as good as theirs. It doesn't matter, really, as to the outcome, whether you saw it directly or you repeat from somebody who saw it. So I see the bird and I say the bird is yellow, and somebody hears me and says the bird is yellow, the statement is the same whether I direct experience or repeat the direct experience of somebody qualified to see. So it doesn't matter. That's why we have to hear from somebody like Vyasadeva and learn how to repeat adequately what Vyasadeva has given us. I want to do one final text, number 14, here. Here we see, he just says, finally he sums up this little business of the difficulties of what he's said, of what he's done. Whatever you desire to describe that is separate in vision, that is separate from in vision from the Lord, simply reacts with different forms, names, and results to agitate the mind as the wind agitates a boat which has no resting place. Now here in the purport we see that there is in here a beginning of an implicit critique of what Vyasadeva has done. Something, a prithak drishaha, a separate vision. Separate vision from the Lord. And Prabhupada has said in the purport, actually there's nothing separate from Krishna. Everything is related to Krishna. So if we are seeing as separate from Krishna, that is maya. But specifically, Prabhupada says, let me just read this. Sri Vyasadeva is the editor of all descriptions of the Vedic literatures, and thus he has described transcendental realization in different ways, namely by fruitive activities, speculative knowledge, mystic power, and devotional service. So those four different things are discussed in the Vedic literature. Besides that, notice how I don't say literatures, I say literature. Please follow that direction. Besides that, in his various Puranas, he has recommended the worship of so many demigods in different forms and names. The result is that people in general are puzzled as how to fix their minds in the service of the Lord. See, demigods, if you emphasize them as separate from Krishna, that's also this false vision. So he says, Narada Dev is stressing this particular defect in the Vedic literatures compiled by Vyasadeva, and thus he is trying to emphasize describing everything in relation with the Supreme Lord and no one else. Now, this is very interesting what happens in this purport. Then Prabhupada goes on to explain, there is nothing existent except the Lord. Nothing is different from Krishna. The Lord is manifest in different expansions. So there's nothing different except the Lord. Therefore, Srila Vyasadeva should not have compiled any Purana other than the Bhagavata Purana. This is the hardest statement I've found in this chapter. He actually shouldn't have done it, because a slight deviation from that may create havoc for self-realization. If a slight deviation can create such havoc, then what to speak of deliberate expansion of the ideas separate from the absolute truth, personality of Godhead? The most defective part of worshiping the demigods is that it creates a definite conception of pantheism. What is pantheism? Huh? No, that's polytheism. Yeah, pantheism. He didn't say polytheism. He said the worst thing about demigod worship is not polytheism, which there's worship of many gods, but pantheism, which is associated with, I won't say it's equivalent to, but associated with monism. Pantheism is the doctrine, as you said, everything is God. Or that nature is God. He mentioned Spinoza. Famous statement of Spinoza's, Deus sive natura, God or nature. That nature and God are the same thing. As pantheist is, they worship everything as God. It's usually nature worship. Got a few lines from Wordsworth or something. You know, the romantic poets really went into it. Avoid them, huh? Nature worship. Worshipping nature as God. Also, Prabhupada refers it to worshipping the cosmic organism as God. That's an organized philosophy. The world is an organism, a living organism, and that organism is divine, the greatest being that we know. And we are as cells to the cosmos. So that's pantheism. So demigod worship, because what happens to this demigod worship in the Vedic context is that all the demigod worships are considered to be separate and equal manifestations of the unknowable one that lies behind them. And that one that lies behind them is an impersonal one. And that's monism, the doctrine that it's all one, from mono, meaning one, mono, monism. So usually these goes together. It goes together in this weird idea that as long as we see the variegated material world around it, everything is God, but actually everything is unreal and there's only one unmanifested reality, and that oneness is the absolute. So these two go together. Polytheism is just the worship of many different gods without maybe any idea of an underlying unifying principle like that. But pantheism is there's one underlying unifying divine. But see how Prabhupada says this. He says here, in fact, there is nothing existent except the Lord. How does that differ from pantheism? Yeah, the Lord's a person. Prabhupada says, the pantheism is not entirely false. The trouble is, it's partial truth. So Prabhupada, you know, the whole truth is achincha bheda abheda tattva. So while nothing is different from Krishna, Krishna remains different from everything. Krishna includes the world. At the same time, he transcends it. So even though everything you see is Krishna's energy and nothing is different from Krishna, Krishna is still a transcendent individual person. So it's different from pantheism. Although it includes pantheism as a kind of part of it. Usually when people go wrong, they take some little part of the truth and run with it. Just like there are demigods, but that doesn't mean there's polytheism. It's true there is oneness, but that doesn't mean monism is the truth. Those things we have to see, and it's time to stop. Any final questions on this? Yeah? Spinoza. Benedict Spinoza or Baruch Spinoza.